Well, it's hard to believe that Easter was an entire week ago. Seems like it was yesterday for me, partially because now we have a Thursday service, so I don't have 6.5 days to recover. We turn around and we do this thing. I have 3.5 days to recover now. So it comes quick, but I wanted you to know we had 4 services, and we had right around 1,100 people come to Easter. So cool, so cool. And we don't know all that God will do with that. We really do kind of just believe that God's kind of like seeds God plants, and we'll see the cool stuff that he's going to do with that. So hey, before I jump in, I wanted to shamelessly and selfishly plug my small group that's going to be starting here, not tomorrow, but next Monday. It's called the New to Mosaic Group. So if you're newer to the church and you just maybe not quite sure what the next step in might be, one of the next steps in could be coming to this group. It's 6 weeks long, so you're not like signing your whole life away, and you kind of get an inside peek at where we came from, where we're going, kind of a little bit of my heart and some of the inner workings. So it's a really cool next step, get to know some people. So if that's something you're interested in, you can talk to the Welcome Center. You could do it online like a normal person if you want. But I would love to have you at my house for 6 weeks. All right, let's get going. I got caught up reading stupid stuff on the internet the other day, which is just like every day. But I was reading one of those articles where the dictionary puts out like, hey, we've added these words to the dictionary. You've seen those? So like every year they add words to the dictionary. Like if people say a word enough, the dictionary's like, that's a word now. So they did that. I read one, and then I just got caught up reading the past couple of years because it was fun to kind of try and guess what the words meant if I didn't know them, and a lot of them I didn't know. So I thought I'd bring this to you. I want to show you a couple words. So the first one I want to show you that I thought was interesting is the word Blur's Day. You ever seen this? Blur's Day? So this one, that's interesting. This is a day not easily distinguished from other days, or the phenomenon of days running together. So if you ever have that happen where you're like, I don't even know what day it is. It's Blur's Day. That's just, they're all the same. That's like every Wednesday for me. I don't know what day it is. It's Wednesday. No, Blur's Day. Another one I liked is the word confuddle. You ever seen this one? Confuddle, not befuddle, confuddle. I think confuddle rolls off the tongue nicer. So this one is a state of extreme confusion or frustration, to perplex, confuse, confound, muddle, mix up a person, confuddle, or math, right? No. Only like 3 people got that. Cool. The next one's very interesting. Have you heard this? Goblin mode. It's in the dictionary now. This is real, okay? So this is a type of behavior which is unapologetically self-indulgent, lazy, slovenly, or greedy, typically in a way that rejects social norms and expectations. So you can go goblin mode. That's me every week on my day off. I go goblin mode. All right, last one I want to show you. I don't want to say it. I just want to put it on the screen, and you can try to pronounce it. Have you seen this word? I know what you're thinking. Zahuzza? Zahuzza? Is that what it looks like? Believe it or not, you pronounce this zhuzh, zhuzh, zhuzh. Never would have guessed that. But here's what it is, and I like this word. I'm going to start using it. When a dish, an outfit, or your writing needs a little more oomph or extra sparkle, it needs some zhuzh. Zhuzh, just a little, it's missing something. What's it missing? Zhuzh, that's what it's missing. So hopefully the sermon isn't missing any zhuzh today. All right, so you're welcome. Your vocabulary is expanded now. You can use those words or forget they ever existed. Here's something I've noticed, though, and this is a weird thing when you have kids that happens. So I actually, words are kind of my thing. I really like words. And you ever talk around your kids and use normal human words and words you've used your whole life, and you have like one of your young kids go, what does that word mean? And all of a sudden, you're worried that you've been using it wrong your entire life. You can't come up with a definition. Has that ever happened to you? Like, it can be a totally normal word. Like, Daddy, what's the word important mean? I know what it means, but it's hard to, like, the moment you get put on the spot for that. And my instinct, and especially with the smaller kids, is I always want to use bigger words to explain a more simple word. So, it means of utmost You can't use the word in the crap. Okay, so you can't use the word in the definition. You're going to go like of utmost significance. Now, my six-year-old's not going to be able to understand those two words either, so you just go down this rabbit trail of defining words and defining words and defining words. So I don't know if you've ever been there where you use a word, you're confident that you're using it right, but you might not be able to actually define it. And I want to talk about a word today. A word. A single word. And if you grew up in church, you've used this word hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. Even if you didn't grow up in church, you've probably used this word. You've certainly heard it used all the time. It is, in my opinion, when it comes to being a Christian, this is the most important word. This is it. Like, without this word, you're not a Christian. Like, you, this is a necessary ingredient. You have to have this word or you're not even, you don't even get it. You're not in. But as vitally important as this word is, I wonder if it's kind of like that thing that happens where I use this word all the time, but do I really understand it? So the word I want to look closely at today is the word grace. Grace. So we're starting a series today called How to Christian. And the idea is we're just going to look at the very basic necessities of what it means to be a Christian. And as I started thinking about that idea, like, okay, how to Christian, where should we start? I came to the conclusion that you have to start with grace. This has to be the beginning point. This has to be the foundation. This has to be where it all starts. Because this word, like I said, without this word, you don't have a Christian. This is that important. So, grace. How should we go about this? How can I explain grace? We could do the school kind of thing. I could tell you that grace, the word grace, is found in the Bible 170 times. That the Greek word in the New Testament that's translated grace is the word charis. Charis. Now it's the thing you know. We could do definitions. I had an old lady when I first started at this church, way back when we were Grace and Truth Church, over on Wadsworth Road by the hospital in that little green building. This is this old lady. She was old, and she was aggressive, and she's like, she wanted to give me the definition of grace. Do you remember in church, if you grew up in church, remember when acronyms were really popular? Like, everything was an acronym. It was like late 90s. Everything was an acronym. So she had an acronym for the definition of grace, and it was, you know, the word grace. God's riches at Christ's expense. That was her acronym. And good, theologically sound definition. That was the only definition she would accept. Like I said, she was a little aggressive. She played the organ. Everything you're imagining is exactly right. I could give you a scholarly definition. Do you want to hear a scholarly definition? Good, you have to. Grace manifests as the unmerited beneficence of the divine toward humankind, engendering salvation independent of anthropocentric merit or deeds. It bifurcates into common and salvific dimensions, underscoring the gratuitous nature of divine favor and transcends mere human comprehension. Did you get the last part, though? Transcends mere human comprehension. That definition transcends mere human comprehension. Is that helpful? No. I have a very simple, the definition I like the best when it comes to grace is just two words: undeserved favor. Undeserved favor. But here's something that's interesting to me, like most interesting to me. Did you know that even though this word is 170 times said in the Bible, that Jesus never once says it? Jesus never said the word. Not one time. All four Gospels, Jesus never says the word grace. Arguably, like I'm the most important word, this word of all words, Jesus never says it. Now, what does that mean? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this word isn't as important as I'm saying. Or maybe Jesus has a different way of teaching besides acronyms and scholarly definitions. Maybe Jesus understands that knowing a definition of a word doesn't mean you actually understand the thing. So, for example, what if someone didn't know what a sunset was? How would you go about explaining that to them? Would you give a definition? At the time in the evening when the sun disappears, There you go. That's what a son said. Or would it be better to take them outside, wait for the time of the day when a sunset hits, and go, there it is? Wouldn't that be better than a very scholarly definition of the word? Have them experience it. And I think that's the way Jesus went about things. Instead of having people memorize vocab words, he put things on display. He showed them. He wanted them to experience grace. So what I want to do today is I want to look at a story in Jesus' life where grace is on display. And it's one of my favorite Jesus stories. It's found in John chapter 8. We'll start in verse 1. Jesus returned to the Mount of Olives, but early the next morning he was back again at the temple. A crowd soon gathered, and he sat down and taught them. So that's like the setting of our story. And the cool part about this one is, like, you don't have to use very much of your imagination because the setting is basically exactly what we're doing now, right? You have a crowd of people listening to a sermon. Big difference is that it would be Jesus teaching it and you'd be way more interested and way more into it because it would be Jesus and it would be way better than whatever it is I'm trying to do right now. But it's the similar. So you don't have to use much of your imagination. This is what was happening. You had a crowd of people listening to someone teach. That's what's happening. So here's the action, verse 3. As he was speaking, the teachers of the religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery. They put her in front of the crowd. So, man, you just got to picture this. This is like a movie scene. A group of guys burst in, and they come up to the front, and they drop this woman in front of, notice it said in front of the crowd, so it wasn't just like some little thing off to the side. They wanted everybody to see this. And she was caught in the act of adultery. So we don't know what state she was in, clothed, barely clothed. Like, this doesn't sound like a fun situation for her. And they throw her down in front of everyone. Can you imagine what that would do to a room? Like, you're kind of sitting all comfortable listening, and all of a sudden, boom, like this interruption hits. Everybody's adrenaline would be pumping. Everybody would be, if you weren't paying attention before, you are now, right? Like, what is happening? So it's a move by these men to definitely a shock and awe and intimidation of the crowd and of Jesus, and certainly meant to shame her. So here's what they want to do with this. Verse 4, "Teacher," they say to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" Okay, so if this is your first time interacting with this story, you might be like, it's like a weird, really weird Bible trivia. What are we doing here? But actually, what these guys are doing, this is a very clever trap. They believe that there's only two ways to answer this question. So they came in believing that Jesus has got two options, and really, no matter how he answers it, they think they've got him. They're trying to trap him. So he could go with option A, and he could say, yeah, it does. I wrote it. It does. So, stoner. He could say, go for it. Now, a couple problems with option A. If you go with option A, one, Jesus has this reputation of being merciful and a friend of sinners, and that's not really fit with what he's been doing. Now, I don't think that would stop Jesus, but it doesn't really make sense for him. Secondly, Rome, who was in charge, didn't allow the Jewish people to execute. So here's what I think is happening. I could be wrong, but I think that these men who brought this woman in, I think if Jesus says stone her, I think they came in with rocks in hand. And I think they were going to do it right then and right there. They were going to kill her. And I bet they had some Roman guards who they either paid off and they were, you know, they had a little deal with, that they were going to have the Roman guards come in right as soon as it was over. And the Roman guards were going to be like, what's going on here? And they were going to be like, Jesus told us to. And then Jesus would get arrested and taken care of. So that would be option A. So they think if Jesus says stoner, we're going to do it, and he's going to get in trouble for it, and that's a win for us. Okay, so don't do that then, Jesus. Jesus could say, no, don't do that. Don't stone her. The problem with this option is he would be going against the law of Moses. The law of Moses says that she's supposed to be stoned. So if Jesus says, don't obey the law of Moses, oh my goodness, you can't say in first century Israel, if you talk bad about Moses around Israelites, you're going to be in trouble. Like, that's not a thing you can say. That's a riot-inducing sentence to say. And what these guys planned on doing, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, because this totally doesn't happen in our culture. I think they were going to be outraged. Like, oh, I can't believe you would say that. And then exaggerate even more. He said he hates Moses. They were, going to stir up the crowd against Jesus. And here's what I think they were going to do. They had those rocks. I think if Jesus said, don't stone her, they were going to try and stone him. So either, and this is why they think they've got him, either he says to stone her, and they do, and Jesus gets arrested, or he says not to, and they turn their rocks on him, and he's taken care of that way. So these guys believe they've got him. Catch 22, Jesus, no matter how you answer, you are in trouble. So, armed to kill, either going to kill the girl or kill Jesus, rocks in hand. Now, again, imagine the scene. Imagine you're witnessing this. You went from listening to a sermon to now potentially watching an execution. This is crazy. Like, you would be on the edge of your seat. Everybody would be murmuring. Your heart would be going as if it was happening to you, right? This is a tension-filled moment. What is Jesus going to do? Verse 6. They were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. What? What? Again, like, do you see the situation? Everyone knew this was crazy. Everyone knew that no matter what he chooses, this is not going to be good for him. This is life or death here. This is a huge situation. This is my heart is beating, my adrenaline is pumping, my eyes are dilated. I'm all of my mental focus needs turned on to answer this question. And Jesus is like, hold on a minute, I'm gonna draw something in the dirt. What? Now, what do you do with that? So I've watched a lot of sermons where pastors try to guess what Jesus wrote, and here's the thing. We don't know. John didn't write what Jesus wrote. He didn't tell us. So I think we're not supposed to know. If it's not in there, I don't think we're supposed to know. Now, what I don't want to do is guess and then preach off of what I'm guessing. I don't want you to know. What's the point of that? I could be wrong. So I think we just take it at face value, because John wanted us to know that this is what Jesus did. This is Jesus' knee-jerk reaction to these guys cornering him. So what I think this shows us is that Jesus is just unfazed by impossible situations. Because that's what this is. Everyone watching is like, this is Jesus. Uh-oh, he's screwed. Either way, what's gonna happen? And Jesus is like, I'm gonna draw in the dirt. He's just unbothered by the impossible. Man. Now, can you take that? Can you understand that about your God? That you probably find yourself in situations similar where you feel like there's maybe no way out. You feel like if I choose option A, option B, no matter what, this is not good. Do you understand that you have a God who is unfazed by impossible in your life? Like, that is the kind of God that you have? That Jesus is not up in heaven when you get into one of those situations. Jesus is not up in heaven going, call the angels. We got to figure this out. Look what they did. Look at the situation they got themselves in. We don't know what they got to call a count. No, he is unfazed. Jesus does not have an elevated heart rate. He does not get worried when you have the impossible situations happen in your life. I mean, I hope that should bring you some comfort to know that about your God, that when you hit the impossible, he's not freaking out. He's good. He is in control even when things feel out of control. And that has to be the answer. That has to be why he did this. This was a little bit of a display to us so we can see, this is how I'm going to respond to when things feel out of control in your life. I'm not fazed. I'm not worried. Because this looks like somebody's going to die, and Jesus is like, I'm going to draw in the dirt right now just to show you how little this affects me, because I'm that much in control right now. Kind of seems, again, this feels so much like a movie scene, because these guys came in with rocks ready to kill. And Jesus is like, this is the perfect time to draw in the dirt. So, what are they going to do? How are they going to respond to this unfazed, in control Jesus? Verse 7 and 8. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up again and said, "All right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." And then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. Man. This is one of the reasons that I'm just so blown away by Jesus. This is one of the reasons that I think Jesus is like more than just a good teacher, because that answer, that's divine right there. I mean, nobody saw this coming. Everybody thought he has to go with option A or B, and no matter what, he's in trouble. You know, somebody's dying here today. Everybody thought. And when you read the story, if you don't know the story, you're like, well, how's he going to answer? And he pulls this answer, and this answer is just divine. It's like the only way out that could have possibly been. One sentence. And he ends it. And immediately, it's like, I didn't finish drawing whatever I was drawing, so I'm going to go right back to that. What? It reminds me, you ever watched the Matrix movies? Those are cool. I know I'm aging myself now because they're like 20 years old, but whatever. When Neo got in that fight and he like fought with one hand and he's like yawning. Like that's what Jesus just did, but it was like a verbal fight. Like he just fought him off with one hand and then boom. Well, yeah, well, whoever doesn't have sin can throw the first stone. Like, end of the fight, one sentence. You know what these guys used to do? They used to theologically argue for fun. This could have been a 12-hour debate. They could have went back and forth on the finer points of Moses' law. But instead, Jesus says one sentence, and it's over. And he goes right back to drawing in the dust. I love it. So here's what happens, verse 9. When the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Man, again, so you just got to imagine the scene. Here these guys are, armed, ready to kill somebody. Jesus says one sentence. They drop their rocks, and they start walking off. So if you're in the crowd, you know, you were listening to a nice sermon, huge interruption. Oh my gosh, who's going to die? Jesus says one sentence, and all of a sudden, these guys just start filtering out. Man. Now, you might think, ooh, okay, tension over. But there's a difference between the beginning of the story and now, right? We have the crowd, we have Jesus, but the difference is we also still have the woman. She's still there. And this is a moment. Jesus had his moment with the guys. He said one sentence and it was over. But now, what's he going to do with her? She committed adultery. That's what they said anyways. It is true that the law of Moses says she deserves to be stoned. And listen, like our society, we have a lot of ways we think about this stuff. I think of all the sins that our society has decided aren't sins anymore. I will say adultery seems to still be on the list, right? It seems to still be a big deal. So we understand that this woman, this is a shameful thing that she's done. This is a bad thing that she's done. So here she is. And do you remember what Jesus said? He said, "Let the one without sin cast the first stone." Well, none of them qualified. But I don't know if you know this about Jesus. He does. So this is still a little bit nerve-wracking. Like, if you don't know where the story is going, you're like, wait a minute. That's him. He described himself. He's without sin. He has the right. So what's he going to do? Verse 10. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus said, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." There it is. You see it? It's grace. Just like a sunset. That's it. Better than any definition. That is grace. You might not be able to define it perfectly, but hopefully you know it when you see it. He's putting it on display. He just extended this woman grace, undeserved, unmerited favor. And don't you love the way he did it? This, again, Jesus, like, he's just so above the fray. He like stooped down to write in the dirt again, and he like gets up and he was like, what happened? Where'd they go? Like, you ever see Steph Curry shoot a corner three and he turns around and starts running down the court before it even goes in? That's what Jesus just did. He's like, what happened? I didn't see it. Did it go in? Like, did they leave? Like, it was just that, he's just that, you know, I love it. I love how absolutely in control of the situation he is. Didn't even one of them condemn you? No. And then he says these most grace-filled words, neither do I. And implied in those words is, but I could have, but I won't. Now, don't you think this moment stuck with her for the rest of her life? And I know you're like, well, yeah, because it was trauma. Certainly that part, yes. But his words, Jesus' words to her. Don't you feel like that kind of grace at that kind of level just kind of gets inside your soul and sticks with you? Undeserved favor. So there it is. That's the story. Now, what do we do now? See, I got very frustrated when I was preparing this sermon at this part. Because I love teaching these stories. I love imagining being in the story and getting a feel for all of it. And when I got here, I was like, because I always think about you. Don't get too cocky. But I always think about you. How can I take this idea and put it right inside your brain? And I got worried about this one. Grace. The biggest, most important concept. How am I going to do this? And I paced around my house. Luckily, nobody's home on Thursday when I do sermon prep. So I paced around my house frustratedly. I was preaching 17 different sermons trying to find the thing that I should say. And I finally figured out why I was so frustrated. I was frustrated because I feel like there's two different groups of people who will hear this sermon, and they're kind of on opposite ends of a spectrum. And no matter what I do, if I pull this way, I'm going to push you. And if I pull this way, I'm going to push you. So I was like, that's why I kept going, well, if I wanted to go this way, then I'm like, oh, but this person hears that, they're going to feel a certain kind of way. And then if I go this way, then they're... So I kept going back and forth. So here's the two groups that I think are in the room. And you have to self-qualify. I don't get to go around and be like, you're here. You get to decide which one you're in. I can't... You know that? That's true of any sermon you come to listen to. You kind of have to decide what you're going to do with it, right? If you come, like, I'm going to come and listen, and I'm gonna pick apart what he says. Good, dude, please. There's probably better guys to listen to for stuff like that. Mine's probably pretty easy for you. But, like, if you want this to matter in your life, you have to decide, what are you going to do with this? So you have to self-qualify here. Which one are you? So what, there's one group, and I'm just going to say it. Again, I'm not saying this is you. You have to qualify. There's one group in this room who maybe just doesn't think that their sin is that big of a deal. And maybe that's you. Maybe you're sitting there going, I just don't think that my sin is that big. Now, if that's you, one of the ways you can kind of know that's you is that when we talk about grace, you're not even that impressed. That would be that side. You just don't think that your sin is that big of a deal. But then you have this other side. And this side is exactly the opposite, where they think that their sin is such a big deal that, like, grace can't even cover it. And maybe that's you. Maybe you're like, no, I've messed up. Maybe you've got a thing that you did. And you're like, yeah, I'm not sure grace can cover that. Or maybe you've got a thing that you can't seem to kick. And you're over here and you kind of live your life carrying around a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. So I've got both of these groups in the room right now. Some are like, I just don't even think this is that big of a deal what I do. And others who are like, no, it's so big of a deal, I don't even know if grace can cover me. I've got both. You see my dilemma? Do you feel bad for me? Good. So here's what we're going to do. You ever read those books where it was like a choose-your-own-adventure? And like you got to a certain point, you could pick one page. You know, you turn to one page, you want to make one choice, and you turn to a different page, you want to make it. You remember those? The sermon is now that. So this is a choose your own adventure sermon. So we're gonna turn to one page if you're one, and you're gonna turn to another page. So we're gonna start with I'll say it this way. I'll soften it a little bit just to make sure that you're gonna put you have to decide ahead of time which one you are. So are you a struggle to see your own sin as a big deal, or are you a struggle to accept God's forgiveness because you think your sin is that big? Which one? So if you're sitting here choosing, I'm struggling to see my sin as that big of a deal, I'm being honest, I'm struggling to see it, turn to this page right now. And if you're not, wait, we'll get to your page in a minute. So maybe when I talk about grace, you're just like not that impressed. There's a song called Amazing Grace, and you're supposed to be amazing. But maybe you don't feel that way anymore. Maybe it doesn't feel amazing to you. Maybe when you talk about grace, it kind of pings off of you. You ever get somebody a gift and you think it's amazing? You think it's like the perfect gift. You think you've got, and like you expect them to just like melt and cry and like hug you and cling to you because it was such a good gift. You ever do that before? And then you give it to them and they say this. They say, oh, thank you. And then you cry, right? Because like it didn't do what you thought. It just, like, it didn't mean what you thought it was going to mean to them. What if that's like how you feel about grace? Like I'm building it up to be this amazing gift that God gives us. And you're like, oh, thanks, God. And then if you're honest, you kind of have the, what else? What else you got? What if that's where you're at? Now, why would you be there? If we look at the simplest definition of grace, undeserved favor. Undeserved favor. I think if you struggle to think grace is a big deal, I think the part of it you struggle with is the undeserved part. And remember, you picked this page, so it's your fault. I would say you struggle with the word entitled when it comes to God. You struggle with the word entitled. You think, again, you chose this page. You think God owes you. You think God owes you something. You presume upon his forgiveness. You think you deserve his forgiveness. You think you deserve his love. You think you deserve his blessing. So instead of approaching God humbly and broken, you kind of have the attitude of a little bit of a spoiled teenager. Like, hey, you got that grace that you talk about? Can I have some of that grace? Can I have grace? Grace, can I have it? Like, it's not even that big of a deal. So this is the heart check. And I'll just ask. Again, I'm asking. I don't know if it's true of you. Do you think God owes you something? How can I explain to you that he doesn't? This is the part, man. This is where I get, how can I persuade you that that is not true? I could open up an imaginary theological textbook. Does God owe me? No. That's your answer. He doesn't owe you anything. But like, if you think he does, why? I mean, think about it. You can't give God anything that he didn't already own. So you can't put him in your debt that way. You can't do anything for God that he didn't already deserve. So you can't put him in your debt that way. There's nothing you could do in your existence to put God in your debt. Nothing. He doesn't owe you. He doesn't owe you anything. So I'm not sure I can convince you of that. You could read the whole Bible and you can see the way people approach God is not with an entitled attitude. They approach God humbly and brokenly, accepting anything good that he gives to them as if it is a gift. You could do that. You probably need to do that. How do I explain it? Here's what I'll tell you. Here's my evidence. I bet that if you have the attitude that God owes you something, I bet you're spiritually stuck. So there's my evidence. If you're spiritually growing and you think God owes you something, then I guess I'm wrong. But I'm going to guess that if you have this attitude, God, give me what you owe me, you are stuck spiritually right now. You're not growing. You're probably a little frustrated. Things just aren't really working very well. And that is just going to keep you there because that's not the way you approach God. That's not the way you approach God. You're not going to get anywhere approaching God with the attitude that he owes you something. You have to approach God humbly and broken. And understand that any favor, any forgiveness, any love, any blessing is completely undeserved. We don't earn it. We don't earn. Because in order to understand grace, you have to understand that it's undeserved. I mean, that's a part of it. If you act like God, you deserve God's grace, that destroys the definition. Literally, just, it's not grace anymore. It's a transaction now. And that's the scary thing. You can't have that attitude. That's not Christianity. This is actually what makes Christianity different than every other religion on the planet. It's not transactional. God loves us even when we don't deserve it at all. Every other religion you have to earn. This is not. This is Christianity. Christianity is grace. Christianity is undeserved favor. So if you're not blown away by grace, I worry that it's the way you're approaching God. So here, let's recreate this story. So this woman gets drug in and plopped in front of an audience. Let's say, now let's flip your vantage point. So the first time we told the story, you were the audience, right? So let's flip it around. Now you need to be the woman. You're drug in. But let's forget about 2,000 years ago. Let's just say that the one dragging you is Satan and the place is heaven. You're in God's throne room now. So Satan is dragging you before the throne of God and plopping you down in front of the almighty throne, the highest of the highest. And imagine that the angels are watching, stadium seating all around, billions of them watching. And Satan's got you in the middle of everybody. And he comes up to the throne and he says, "This one here, you, this is a sinner." And he's got evidence. So imagine that Satan then pulls up a YouTube video of your whole life because he's got it. He's got the evidence on you. A YouTube video of you. But it's everything. Imagine that he has footage of everything. Anything you've ever done wrong. The big thing, that thing. He's got that in slow motion. He's got all the small things. The stuff you've done that no one knows, he's got that too. Hidden thoughts that you lingered on longer than you should have, he's got that too. He's got your entire browsing history. He even can tell where your eyes were on the screen. And Satan's got the clicker, so he pauses at the parts you're hoping to fast forward through. He's pausing, he's slowing down, he's showing every detail. He could even see inside your heart with this video, and he sees the different things that happen in your heart. The bursts of pride and envy and lust and all that stuff. He's got all that on display. Every snide comment, every gossipy conversation, every selfish act, every drunk moment, everything, all of it, he has all of it. And he shows everyone. And then he pulls out a Bible verse because Satan's good at that. He doesn't read the whole thing because it would ruin his argument. But he reads Romans 6:23, the beginning part that says, "For the wages of sin is death." And then he turns to the throne and he says, "What do you say?" Just like these guys did for this woman. "What do you say? The wages of sin is death. Have I not proved it? What do you say?" There's that moment again. So I imagine, if you're a Christian, what's going to happen in that moment is Jesus is going to get off the throne. And it's his throne room. So I always imagine Jesus getting in Satan's face, like, I cannot wait for that moment. I want to see this fight, because it's not going to be much of one. But I want to see Jesus come get in Satan's face. And what you need to know is he's going to say guilty. They're guilty. Obviously. He just had the whole video. But let him go free. Because he paid for it. He paid for all of it. He paid for it. That is grace. That Jesus sees you exactly as you are. He sees the whole video. He sees everything you've ever done. And he paid for it on the cross. That's grace. You gotta be blown away by that. That's gotta hit you. You need to know that, like, your sin is a big deal, that is going to happen. Because I think when we think our sin isn't a big deal, one of the things that happens is we're comparing ourselves to other people and we think, well, I'm not bad compared to them. But if you imagine that video playing in front of all the angels and God in heaven, you don't feel so good. You're wanting to climb underneath the floor of heaven and hide there. That's grace. Undeserved, unmerited favor. Jesus paid for it. I hope it can impact you. Okay, so if that was you, you turn to that page. All right, maybe you're on the other side and you struggle to accept God's forgiveness because you feel like your sin is that big. So turn to this page if that's you. I'm here. I struggle with this one. So I've been a Christian for 35 years. It's crazy to say that sentence. I got saved in first grade. Mrs. Keys was my teacher. I remember it vividly. I went to a Christian school, so she shared Jesus, and I accepted Jesus every single day that week, so I have like 7 Jesus in my heart. I was all about that. That's why I became a pastor, because I have more Jesuses than you in my heart. It's theologically incorrect. I went to Christian elementary school. I went to Christian college. I went to Christian grad. I've been a Christian for 35 years. I've been a pastor. I've been lead pastor for 13. I've been a pastor for longer than that. When I screw up, the main thing I always feel is like, I should know better. I should be better than this by now. I wonder at God's patience. Like, for me, this is where Satan will get me. Like, yeah, he forgave all those other people, but God's blessed you way too much. You shouldn't be doing this anymore. Maybe he's done with you. Maybe he's run out with you. That's the thing that he gets me on. And maybe that's where you're at. Or maybe for you, it's just one big thing that you did. One big thing. And that seems to be the thing that you're like, that's bigger than God's grace, or it seems to haunt you. And or maybe you just live with a general sense of shame or guilt all the time, like a weight on you. And if that's you, I want to read you one verse. I think you should tattoo this verse backwards on your forehead so you see it every single time you look in the mirror. Romans 8:1. So now there is no condemnation for those who belong to Christ Jesus. How much? Wait, so if you're a Christian and you've accepted what Jesus did on the cross, there's no condemnation? None? Well, what about when I do that thing though? Is there a little bit then? No, it says none. But if I keep doing it though, what about then? No, none. What about that big thing though? There's a big thing? None. None. No condemnation. Zero. Zilch. Nothing. None. No condemnation. You have none. Why are you carrying it around? This says you have none. That's what Jesus said to her, right? Did any of them condemn you? Neither do I. No. None condemnation. Zero. None. It's gone. It's gone. He took everything you did, all of your sin, all of it onto the cross. He took all of it. It's gone. He knew everything you were going to do when he did it, and he still died for you. You're clean. You're clean. You don't have to hold that anymore. You don't have to walk around feeling kind of guilty anymore. Now listen, here's the thing. Certain churches are scared to teach this because if I tell you, hey, like Jesus died for all your sins, all of them, so I can do what I want? Well, technically, sure. But if you really get it, if you really understand that he died for you like that, you won't want to. Something's going to start to shift inside your heart. You're going to be drawn to living the way he wants you to live. You really understand what he did. So I'm not afraid of that. I feel like if you really use this as some excuse to go do whatever you want, you didn't understand it in the first place. So you need to know you are clean. He died for you on the cross. There is no condemnation. Still says no. You don't have to carry that around anymore. Grace. Undeserved favor. That's what this is. That's what Christianity is. This is square one. You don't have to work for it. You don't have to try for it. You just have to accept it. Jesus died for you. He loves you. Undeserved favor upon you. Forgiveness, love, blessing. You didn't earn it. You didn't deserve it. That's where it starts. That's where it starts. Just like Cassandra said, he loves you right where you are. Right as you are. And way too much to leave you there. Way too much to leave you there. Pray with me. Jesus, thank you for this story. I love it. I wish I could have been there. I would have loved to see your wisdom and your power and your grace on display like that. I pray for the person in the room right now, Lord, who maybe just hasn't felt like their sin is that big of a deal. Maybe grace hasn't been all that impressive to them. Maybe they're struggling with this idea that you owe them something. Lord, I pray that you would help them in that. Even in that. That's how amazing you are, that you would even be gracious in that. You would even be gracious with the person who feels like you owe them. Lord, I'm blown away by that. I pray that you would fill them up with that. Help them to see. See you as you really are and see themselves as they really are. Lord, I pray for the person who's struggling with feeling like their sin is too big or too often to be covered by your grace, I pray that they would see the tsunami that it is, that your grace is so much bigger and so much more powerful than anything they've ever done. I pray for the Christian, Lord, who walks around with shame and guilt. I pray that they would be free and that freedom would draw them to you, Lord. That itself would be a power drawing them to you so that they wouldn't have to walk in that anymore. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.